Thank you for gathering today to have this conversation. I think that it is important for us to reflect on the report that came out of the interview committee. When I went into that room to have that conversation, I went in with a spirit of collaboration. I did not go in expecting an interrogation, and I'm not expecting that that will continue today. I am expecting that, the collaborative approach and a dialogue will take place. I wanted to speak a little bit about how we got into this room today. Those of you who have come as spectators, those of you who are members of the sub-executive, and those of you who have come to speak. And we come from a variety of trajectories to this room. Some of us have been lifelong members of the United States of Canada, born into a denomination that itself was born less than a century ago, but born into a progressive understanding of theology, of scholarship, of welcoming a diverse and eclectic group of people within its walls and under its roof so that it could be about the work of transforming society and making it a community of love, of justice, and of compassion. So many of us have come through that. Some of us have joined the church from other Christian denominations, but there are many in this room who have come who had no denomination, no Christian relationship, no relationship with any faith tradition whatsoever, who felt the need for a community that would call them to those things that the United Church speaks that it is about, to compassion, to justice, to living in right relationship. And so I welcome you to this space, to the court that is formed here today, those of you for whom this is yet a strange thing, but who have come here through West Hill United Church and what it has offered to you. Throughout the period of this review, it has been a challenge to remain effective as a minister while trying to respond to the many needs and concerns of the review itself. And so on occasion, I have conflated things that I have had to do in order that I'd only have to do them once. We have been, over the course of the last several weeks at West Hill, looking at the attitudes of mindfulness and walking our way through those attitudes. Ironically, last Sunday, the attitude we explored was acceptance, had been laid out several weeks before, and the readings chosen sometime before, but they fit the nature of what was happening that week. And so because I don't shoot birds and don't advocate the shooting of birds, I will cast two seeds with one hand today, and I will share with you my thoughts on this week's attitude, this week's mindfulness attitude, and that is generosity. I do this because I believe that that is the tradition of the United Church of Canada, and I call you today to generosity. I have with me the reading that will be shared at the church this Sunday, a reading that comes from a book by Rebecca Solnit called A Paradise Built in Hell. Rebecca studied disasters, beginning with the earthquake and fire in San Francisco in 1906 and ending with Hurricane Katrina in 2006. And she found that in every instance, the first thing that people do is reach out to one another, to hold one another in care, to ignore whatever barriers may have existed between them, whether cultural, racial, socioeconomic, to just leave those behind and to greet one another as individuals. And so her book is a profound contribution to who we can be as individuals in society. This is actually quoted from Krista Tippett's On Being, a conversation that Solnit had with Tippett on the radio about that book. And I think of that as kind of funny, this funny way the earthquake shakes you awake, and then that sort of the big spiritual question, how do you stay awake? How do you stay in that deeper consciousness of that present-mindedness, that sense of non-separation and compassion and engagement and courage, which is also a big part of it, and generosity? People are not selfish and greedy. So the other question is, why has everything we've ever been told about human nature misled us about what happens in these moments? And what happens if we acknowledge, as I think people in the kind of work that neuropsychologists and the Dalai Lama's research projects and economists are beginning to say, what if everything we've been told about human nature is wrong and that we're actually very generous, communitarian, altruistic beings who are distorted by the system we're in, but not made happy by it? What if we can actually be better people in a better world? And so I'm framing my my words today, and my phone is not going to tell me the time, so it's going to turn off. I tried to fix that, but I can't. I'm going to frame... You'll let me? Okay, great. He'll take care of me there. I'm going to frame my words in terms of earthquakes. The earthquakes that have happened that brought the United Church into being, that have taken place during the history of the United Church, and recognize that the moment that we are in right now is a moment of an earthquake. Perhaps the very first earthquake in the United Church of Canada came about before it was even formed, when the three denominations coming into union could not agree what would happen after union. What would happen with that statement of faith that had been written in 1908 and that was going to be embraced by the new denomination in 1925? What would happen to those who had made ordination vows, who had accepted statements of faith that were not reflected in that document? It was a quake of a serious sort, and one that threatened to undermine the entire concept of union and not allow it to take place. And then one individual from the Congregationalists, a denomination that had came into being out of the Anglican Church, a dissenting congregation, had an idea and offered the idea of essential agreement to the church, which meant that all those clergy who had come in from any denomination that was joining union would have the privilege of carrying their own beliefs with them into union, of seeing them recognized, perhaps not fully, but honored the way they were brought in from their traditions. An essential agreement was born. What happened with essential agreement was that it quickly allowed us to be able to ordain people who also could say, you know, I hold to that, but there are some issues here. Because already in 1925, those who founded the church knew that those statements of faith were already at question. There were already people who came into union who questioned the reality of a God with beingness and spoke of a God as metaphor. And so already that conversation was beginning to rumble under the surface and continue. Because of that, the United Church could find, as we have on so many different issues since, a common ground on how to be with one another. Not necessarily what we believed, but how to be, to call ourselves to justice, tinged and woven together with love, to call ourselves to compassion, to call ourselves to a greater vision. And so one of the first things that the United Church did, following on another denomination in the United States, was to ordain women. Did we really want women in leadership? Has it not just been downhill ever since? The question, Richard Holloway put that question to the Church of Scotland because he saw that that was the stitch that taken out of biblical inerrancy. If you take that stitch out and women are ordained, the whole piece starts to unravel. And so perhaps we have been the beginning of that. But we looked at that, and we looked at the challenges, and we looked at the losses and the costs that would have to be paid, and we said these are important costs for us to assume, for us to embrace, because it is right that women should be allowed to lead in this diverse and great church as we challenge the nation to embrace a new understanding of Christianity. Shortly after that, another earthquake hit in the form of the Second World War, and Japanese Canadians were being lodged in internment camps, refused to move freely amongst community. The United Church recognized the earthquake, the shame inherent in that, and they quickly spoke against that practice at that time. Shortly after that, they took a step back and looked at the residential schools that they had inherited at Union. And in 1949, they began closing those unions, those schools, finally recognizing the tragedy that they had been for First Nations and Indigenous peoples and their heritage across the decades. We stepped up and spoke loudly and clearly about universal health care in the 1950s, recognizing that it was a right that all Canadians could share, should share. We weren't popular about that, but we asked ourselves, what is generosity if not allowing other people health? And so we stepped into that work and we did it proudly. And then I was born. That's not funny, I was. I was born in the year that a statement was agreed upon that would guide the creation of the new curriculum. that 10 years before John Robinson's book was published, a committee had started looking at ways that we could bring contemporary Christian scholarship around the Bible, around Christology, around theology, could bring it to the people in the pews. Because we recognize that even in 1925, when there was a gap between what academia talked about in terms of theology and what the people in the pews talked about, that gap was widening every day. And the United Church of Canada did not want that gap to be there. And so in 1952, they began. In 1958, they set the parameters. In 1964, the first book was published, The Way and the Word, written by Donald Mathers, the principal of Queen's Theological College at that time. I went to school with his son, and I knew how he was treated and the difficulty it was for him to absorb some of the vitriol that he received as a result of being so involved in that work. But his work was illuminated by people like Harvey Cox, who wrote The Secular City, recognizing that myth and symbol, we couldn't go forward with exclusively myth and symbol. We needed to build a tradition that taught the values that were inherent in our tradition and made them available to all. That as long as we continue to truck in these fine-tuned symbolic rituals and in the myths that were myths but not understood to be by people in the pews, we were sidelining ourselves from what full community could be. And at the same time, John A.T. Robinson wrote his work and talked about a non-theistic understanding of God, challenging the church around the world to stop using the word for at least 10 years so that we could, if we were going to reclaim it, by the time we introduced it, it would have such a different meaning that people wouldn't recognize it from before. That's when I was born. Shortly after that, Canada was asked to welcome draft dodgers from the United States, and its initial reaction was that it could not do that. But it quickly changed its opinion about draft dodgers, and they are now, many of them, welcome, contributing members of Canadian society. And then the question, can a woman's name really go on the ballot for moderator? Can we tolerate that? Will we survive that kind of change in the United Church? We'd ordained them, but seriously? Seriously, yes. And Lois Wilson became the first female moderator in the United Church of Canada. Not long after that, In God's Image was published, a study that looked at sexuality, issues of sexuality, issues around abortion and a woman's right to her own deciding what happens with her own body. It was so cutting edge that people who wrote that got vitriolic email, not email, it wasn't around then, mail, and were torn down and derided in presbytery meetings and in public for having brought that work forward. We found our way toward the First Nations apology, the 30th anniversary of which we just celebrated, and we worked shoulder to shoulder to dismantle apartheid in South Africa. Every single time, the idea of generosity could have been lifted out of that situation because we had put it there. We had challenged that generosity be part of the story, part of the reality. The United Church of Canada, I often say when I'm speaking around the world, I talk of the United Church of Canada as a table that has a number of different voices at it, diverse voices, diverse theologies, diverse social justice understanding, diverse perspectives on the environment, on the economy, on politics. But there's always one empty chair at that table. And the United Church, with courage, has invited the people from whom they least want to hear to sit down in that chair. And they have emboldened themselves to listen to that person, to the truth that that person has shared with them about sexuality, about Indigenous rights, about the economy, about mental health issues, about gender identity, about anything. Welcome. Sit down with us. Let us hear your story. Let our hearts be broken by what it is you have suffered. And may we find our way to generosity. And so we have continued to change. The United Church, over the past 15 years, has watched a transformation take place in a congregation. In 2001, when I preached that sermon, totally deconstructing God, quite unsuspecting that I was going to do that, I was embraced by my congregational members like never before. I'm sure they thought I was having a complete breakdown. But my board sat down with me to discuss our pastoral relationship, the bond that had brought us together, to determine whether or not that bond had been broken, whether I had compromised the strength of that bond. And they boldly said, let's go there. Let's find what might be beyond the language that ties us to a theological perspective that is not shared by those out there. And why we did that was because the United Church of Canada had been, for generations, had been the voice that mitigated the struggle for the social fabric of community, for the social fabric of a nation. The United Church is why Canada has the social democratic values that it does, because over and again it stepped in and spoke truths that needed to be heard by all Canadians. We have abdicated our responsibility to Canadians by not standing strong in that argument for social mores, for the center of our community. And we have done that because we have believed that belief was what brought us and held us together, that theological doctrine and dogma is what we can represent best in our gatherings, in our Sunday gatherings, and in our annual meetings. That if we tie ourselves to the archaic language of long ago, that will help us retain our understanding of who we are. But we were mistaken. That's not who we are. We aren't people of a theological pedigree. We are people of a pedigree of generosity. And we have lived that out every single time an earthquake has hit us. Every single time we have had the opportunity to speak truth into a moment of fear and loss and uncertainty, we have spoken about generosity, and we have been those people. Early in this millennium, maybe about 2005, 2006, Reginald Bibby started looking at what was happening to religion in Canada, what was happening specifically to Christianity in Canada. He's the sort of go-to sociologist who tells us what we look like. And he knew that religion was declining, and he knew it was declining fast. But his latest study showed that we could build again, that there were religious groups that were going to grow. It was very clear. His statistics showed that just as it always had, it would continue into the future. The size of a Christian church was going to be proportional to those we were accepting as an immigrant population to Canada. In the 1950s, in the 1960s, that was white Christians coming from Europe and from Protestant countries, and that had shifted and changed. And the United Church looked at that trajectory that Reginald Bibby put out there and thought, you know what, we need to go in a direction that is going to welcome immigrant populations. But they made a mistake about that. They felt that meant we needed to move in a more conservative direction. We needed to embrace a more conservative theology. I think that if they had flipped that graph upside down, they would have seen the truth of what was happening from the beginning of the millennia until now. They would have seen that, although few people would acknowledge or admit that they didn't have any belief in God or that they didn't have a connection with the church, that though many people at the beginning of the century weren't really open about sharing that, less so down south than up here, That curve was growing at an incredible rate. And what an opportunity the United Church of Canada might have had if it had recognized that if we move one quarter of a step from where we are, one quarter of a step from where we have been, and we focus and pour ourselves into generosity, which has been our code for everything we ever touched, if we move one quarter of a step into generosity and we let go of some of that language that we use that keeps us apart from people, whether we are someone who believes strongly in God as a being who intervenes in natural affairs and in our lives, or whether we don't, we could leave hold of that language. We could leave hold of that language, and we could bring people into communities that spoke about what underneath we shared, no matter what our beliefs were, that spoke about generosity and compassion and coming together to explore how to live in right relationship with oneself first, with others, and with this planet. And rather than continuing to hemorrhage the numbers that we have in the United Church, we might have made a different impact. We might have not lost that struggle for the center of our communities, which we have now left to religious fundamentalists and libertarian relativists, a mix that can only create confusion and disorientation and trauma. I come here today because I love the United Church. I have loved what it has stood for. I have loved who it has been. I have loved the people around me that have been nourished by it, who have been trained within it, who have found their way beyond the boxes that we are now finding ourselves moving into. So I come with love, but I come with lament. Lament mostly because this is the first opportunity I've had to talk with you that wasn't in response to a particular set of questions. Lament because you have never sat down and talked with these noble people who have carried this work no matter what the costs have been, and they have been great and have continued to move forward. I come with lament because the system, the process that has been created here, allows for very little room. And you need room. You need room for generosity, not just in this room, but in the church beyond us. Julian, did you want to add something?
Chair, members of conference executive, my timer says 9 minutes on it, and that's scary if you give a lawyer 9 minutes. So I want you to know that I'm extremely grateful for your patience in allowing me to supplement what Reverend Vosper said, but I'm alive to the fact that hearing from the lawyers isn't really the point of today, and I'll try to be helpful rather than self-indulgent. One of the documents that was made part of the record today came to you, Reverend Allen, last night at 6:47 p.m. And it's a email from Reverend Bill Wall, retired Reverend Bill Wall. I asked Reverend Vosper this morning, I asked Greta this morning, I don't know why we do this stuff. So I asked Greta this morning, I said, do you know him? She doesn't know him. She's never corresponded with him. I find that interesting because of the words in this email are just so striking. He is the past executive secretary of Saskatchewan Conference for 15 years, from 1985 to 2000. And as recently as last night, this is what he wrote. After carefully reading, and I'm picking pieces of this, so please forgive me if it looks like I'm cherry-picking, but the gist of the entirety of this is part of the record, and I encourage people to read the whole thing. After carefully reading the report of the review committee and other relevant materials, I'm convinced that the sub-executive is faced with a decision that could substantially alter the future of the United Church of Canada, in addition to damaging the life of one of its more capable and committed ministers. Greta has proved herself committed to the principles of the United Church has stood for over the course of its history. And he lists those principles: an educated ministry, freedom of thought, compassion for those who suffer, and social justice. Whatever Greta has said about the person of Jesus, I suspect he would recognize her as a true follower, and therefore deserving of the title Christian, even if she doesn't claim that title for herself. Now, I am the least example of a religiously oriented, devoted person. I'm just not very good at it. So I don't want to,
I can make you better.
I don't want to pretend that I am, or that I have knowledge that I don't have, or a history that I don't have. I want to be respectful of your church and the devotion you have all shown to your church. I have had the honor of assisting the United Church in a number of different capacities over the years. And I have always been struck, and I said this in closing to the interview committee, and I'm kind of honored they repeated the words several times, I've always been struck by the big tent that the United Church is. And I said that to the interview committee when I closed last time. But what struck me most was this letter, because the way he puts it after describing Greta as something that she doesn't claim for herself, as he says, the decision facing you is whether to facilitate an unprecedented step, that of putting one of our ministers on trial for pushing the boundaries of theological thought. I trust you will ponder deeply the consequences of your decision and ask yourselves how many ministers within our church could honestly reaffirm their vows for ordination, commissioning, or admission without the benefit of the essential agreement provision, a provision that for 91 years has provided ministers with some leeway for theological interpretation and personal integrity. This destructive and unjust process could stop here if you were willing to do what is necessary to stop it. I respectfully ask you to do just that. Now, the recognition that Greta Vosper has all of these things, an educated ministry, freedom of thought, compassion for those who suffer, and social justice, this sounds like the heart of your organization. As I said, I know very little, and I mean to be respectful, but I have to say this. You are a victim of your own essence. Your openness, your fearlessness, your willingness to embrace principled debate is to be contrasted with the typical thought police approach of many religions. You're a victim of that now because you're engaged in it. I have to say that I worry, as an outsider, that I fear if you lose Greta, I fear you will lose a piece of yourself far bigger than Greta, far bigger than West Hill. I look at the report, a report where 20% of the members, 4 of 23, I'm not trying to make the number bigger than it is, I'm not doing a lawyer thing, but that 4 of 23, 20% of that interview committee, saw what Greta stood for as something similar to, as they put it, many ministers and laypersons. Now you can agree or disagree with them, but obviously this is a very principled debate for which there is no right or wrong answer. Putting Greta on trial isn't a way to have a principled debate. It's a way to ensure my kid goes to a college in the U.S., I suppose. It's the worst thing you can do to yourselves. Like, I am the carpenter who's telling you don't hire the carpenter. I'm the plumber who's telling you don't hire the plumber. Don't reduce this to a piece of litigation. I have been in enough formal hearings. Some of the worst and most atrocious allegations, some of the pettiest allegations I have seen over the years, a number of different matters tried by way of formal hearing. What is interesting about this one is it's one of the few times I will honestly tell you a hearing is a huge mistake. Dividing your church, as you can see it doing it right now, isn't healthy. A hearing that decided that Greta should no longer be a minister will not end the matter. It will actually start a much bigger fissure within your community, within your church. For what? For what end? She is obviously a healthy part of your process. She contributes. She makes you healthy by recognizing the importance of debate and of dialogue. She makes the point that you have created safety for ministers and congregations alike in engaging in debate. You have created that safe space. Don't be afraid to embrace it now. I'm not saying reject the interview committee outright if you feel that would go too far. Put it on hold. There's no rush. Put it over for a year. Structure a debate. You have heard. You've heard from the dissenting members. You have heard from extremely credible individuals such as Reverend Wall. But there are many more. It is within your power to adjourn this for 1 year. That is the entertaining the recommendation for a hearing while you structure the debate that needs to take place. Dialogue, not discipline,
is really recognizing that there are more than Greta Vosper at stake here. And I understand the theory that your membership is in decline, but I can't believe that a way to fix numbers is by becoming more closed, more dogmatic, and less vital as a trade place for ideas. She represents ideas. She represents actually the essence of what I thought the United Church was about. What interests me, and I say this candidly, most of the cases I do, you will understand, the clients never help themselves. It's probably not a great idea they talk. I've never seen many clients in the stand make their case better by the time they left the stand. I say that with all due respect to all of the clients I deeply love. Greta is an exception. When Greta speaks, we all listen. There's a reason for that. Reverend Wall said it best. A true follower, deserving of the title, even if she doesn't claim that for herself. Please don't lose sight. Please don't lose sight of the opportunity here to embrace dialogue. This does not have to be a win-lose. This need not be a litigation paradigm. This needs to be a structured and open dialogue reflective of who your church is. Thank you.
To refrain from responding to speakers by clapping or by acting in any way. I appreciate your enthusiasm, but I did ask that you remain a silent observers, and would ask you to continue to do that, or to begin to do that. Thank you.